The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Werke, Judge Connolly, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
All right. Good morning, everyone. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Tuesday, March 25th, 2025, and we have four cases on the calendar today, three of which are scheduled for oral argument. I am here today presiding over a panel with Judge Werke and Judge Connolly, and we're holding arguments today via zoom.gov. And I'm going to just address a few items before we get started. The oral arguments today are recorded by the court, and the audio of those recordings are generally available on the website within 24 hours. I also just would note for the record and for the participants that Appellate Rule 134.10 prohibits anyone from making an audio or video recording of the oral argument without having received the court's permission 24 hours in advance. And with that, Marshall, please call the first case before us today.
Now calling A241271, Brianne Goad versus City of Duluth versus Senate Blacktop LLC.
Okay. Counsel, you may be aware you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you look at your screen, there should be a clock in the upper right or left hand in gallery mode. That clock will reset according to the time you have for your argument. Please remember to introduce yourself and identify who your client is so we have that for our recording. And with that, I just want to note you can change your name on the screen. It looks like you've both already done that. And just please mute yourself, but leave your video on when you're not speaking. And if anyone has an issue with the technology at any point in time, please let me know because we want to pause and make sure that we can hear everything. And we'll get that addressed. So, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paige Orca. I represent the City of Duluth. We are requesting the reversal of the district court and that summary judgment be entered in the city's favor. At summary judgment, the city sought to have the district court enter judgment in full for the city, or at a minimum, to narrow the scope of issues for trial. Instead, the district court incorrectly analyzed statutory immunity, applied incorrect law as to the failure to warn claim, and applied a heightened incorrect standard as to the open and obvious condition doctrine. Today, we're asking the court for three specific rulings. This can be done in an unpublished decision, as everything we're asking is right in line with the court's precedent. First, to correct the district court's error and conclude that statutory discretionary immunity may bar failure to warn claims. Second, to correct the district court's error in denying the immunity of the city from plaintiff's claim based on constructive notice. And third, to correct the district court's error as to the open and obvious conditions standard. I'll first discuss statutory immunity, where the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Steinke and this court's decision in Zaski control the analysis. Then I'll discuss how open and obvious condition applies in this case to the sign base, which is the at-issue problem condition. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Steinke versus Andover instructed that discretionary immunity can apply to claims of failure to warn. Specifically in Steinke, the court held that the county was immune from a lawsuit based on its alleged failure to place a sign that denoted where a ditch was. In our case, the district court wrote that immunity was not afforded to warning the public of known hazards. And this is important, even if there was a policy in place for the city regarding sign maintenance, that did not absolve the city from its duty to warn the public of known hazards. That is contrary.
Ms. Arca, so when you look at the Supreme Court decision that reversed the Court of Appeals, it said you have to have more than an affidavit saying that this is what happened. So we get you don't have to have a policy, but where's the guts of it that you would have presented something as to the how or why that policy developed? And I think that's what's missing from your case. So can you tell us where that would be in the record, please?
Yes, Your Honor. In our briefing, we've denoted the testimony as well as the affidavits of the two city employees who really live and breathe this policy. Mr. Hakala, who's the city employee for the
Right, Mr. Hakala and Mr. Young, but they have affidavits. But how did that practice come up? What's the history? Where was that? How was that demonstrated? I mean, you don't just go out and do it one day, and it seems to me that the legs of that decision making are nowhere to be found. How that policy, how that conduct, how that determination by Hakala, the guy that was the traffic maintenance guy, how that came about. Is there anywhere that we have missed that as far as our record?
I believe the city presented enough testimony in the form of depositions as well as the one affidavit as to what the policy is, despite that it's unwritten, it's been in place for 20 years, and that the consideration for that policy is based on balancing the limited budget we have in terms of actual dollars and cents, labor and time for our one city.
Which deposition?
Mr. Hakla and Mr. Young both provided deposition testimony as to the sign, well, not even the sign policy, the way in which the city approaches sidewalk maintenance.
And how it developed?
I believe it's based on how the balancing of those, the time and the lack of the budgetary constraints.
Ms. Orcutt, is it a written policy?
It is not a written policy, Your Honor.
And you know, I mean, I agree with you. The cases you're citing are what the law used to be. But following up on Judge Werke's question, you know, it seems like now, you know, in reviewing the Doe versus Best Academy opinion, which is the recent opinion by Justice Thiessen, it seems like, you know, just simply saying you have a policy or providing an affidavit that you have a policy, it seems like that's enough. Here I'm looking at his opinion and says, the record provides no evidence about how the hiring practices and protocols that Best Academy used were developed. Under our general, the municipality must produce evidence that its conduct was a policy decision involving weighing competing social, political, or economic considerations. Best Academy did not meet its burden at this stage of the proceedings. So if we look at the Hakala affidavit, who seems to be the key guy, does he in his affidavit or his deposition say, well, you know, here's the policy weighing competing social, political, and economic considerations? Or is it just more like it's too expensive? You know, that's why we don't do spot checks. We wait for someone to call us. Is that the gist of what his the explanation for the policy is?
I believe that the affidavit specifically of Mr. Hakala does call out that the city weighed its budgetary constraints in coming to this policy. This is the guy, as Your Honor used that language. He's been at the city for 20 years. He really lives and breathes this policy every day. And I
Does he use in his affidavit like competing social, political, and economic considerations? It sounds like he's talking about the budget, so it sounds like he might have made the economic decisions, but do you have the other magic language that seems to be now what the Supreme Court wants?
We do not use those magic words. However, the body of case law, I mean, specifically something like Zadaski versus Lee, where we're talking about an unwritten policy and providing the evidence from the employees who live and breathe that policy, I think we've met that standard. And I don't know if the Doe decision represents a trend away or rather something more specific to employment law, hiring and firing policy decisions, which that body of case law is a little more pointed.
I agree. Employment is different from this case. You're right.
And in if I may too, I had prepped some comments as to how Zaski really mirrors the facts and the holding that should apply in this case. In Zaski, those were a unwritten policy that relied on employees to, as they saw, report. And in that case, this court found that there was subject to immunity. And so in our case, we have that the city does not have a written policy, does not have a maintenance, or excuse me, an inspection schedule. Our employee is not walking the many, many sidewalks of Duluth on a daily basis to determine what defects may or may not be present. And importantly, the district court's decision in this case found that it struggled finding what the policy was. And I think what happened was the district court got lost a little bit in the noise of the way the policy after a report is received is either documented or how the city deals with after the fact reports. And that's not what we assert this immunity for. We're asserting this immunity for the argument that the city should have discovered this sign base in the sidewalk. Because the plaintiff is proffering that, the plaintiff is directly attacking the city's policy, which is a reactionary policy, which is awaiting reports from outside sources. And we admit and we talk about in our briefing that the way that the city receives reports can come a myriad of ways. And that's because any citizen can call the city and the city is going to try to make sure that gets to the right people, right? So all of that noise, I think, more so gets to an argument as to actual notice. But the district court in our case appeared to find too many problems with the fact that the policy wasn't documented as to what it does after it receives a report. And what we're proffering this argument, this policy for in terms of immunity, is for that constructive notice that regardless of the fact that we mean this plaintiff, excuse me, cannot prove actual notice. So instead, I'm going to try to prove that the city should have found this sidewalk sign base. For
But
liability.
what about, what about the argument that, okay, I understand the general policy is, we don't do anything until someone gives us a heads up. But if that is the policy, don't you have to have established procedures about how you get the heads up? And it seems to me the district court was a little concerned. Well, sometimes we take calls, they seem to go, you can call almost anybody. Then there's this portal, which sometimes you use, sometimes you do it. So what about the argument that the policy about how to report wasn't, rational or specific enough to indicate that the city would get proper notice of, a heads up on, hey, there's a problem, with the sign base on, whatever the
That's a good
street
question,
is?
Your Honor. The way in which the city receives reports, it can vary a lot because that's the reality of our world. We won't throw our hands up and say, you didn't get the right person, the right phone call at the right department. Rather, the city will collect from lots of different sources, which is laid out in the testimony of Mr. Young and Mr. Hakala. It can come in an email. It can come in phone calls to various departments. It can come via the online portal.
And what's the evidence that from all those sources, it always gets to the right guy?
That would be the testimony of Mr. Young and Mr. Hakala. They define or they describe that the main person, Tammy Swanson, will receive the reports. Everyone kind of funnels to Tammy. She gets them back out to Mr. Hakala, or if he's absent, his lead worker, and then the city addresses that repair. One thing I hesitate to talk about these types of effects because again, I just don't want this court to get wrapped up in, well, what happens after you get a report? Because that's not what we're asserting the immunity for. We're asserting the immunity to say, the plaintiff cannot prove constructive notice because constructive notice is a direct attack on a policy that the courts should afford immunity based on 466.03 subdivision 6. If I may, with my 2 minutes, I would like to address open and obvious. The record facts in this case show that the sign base itself constituted an open and obvious condition. And in this case, the district court really stopped the analysis on that first prong of openness. The district court applied an incorrect heightened legal standard and said the city had to prove there was absolutely no way possible for this plaintiff to have missed this sign base. I believe that's a heightened standard that goes beyond what the case law has required for open and obvious. And even in the light most favorable to plaintiff, there really aren't any fact disputes on the openness of this sign base. It was visible to plaintiff herself, and because it's objectively visible, that means open, essentially. When we get to the next steps of the analysis in terms of obviousness, or despite the open and obviousness, you have to anticipate the risk of harm. The obviousness, this is a this poses a tripping hazard. It's about 2 inches from a couple estimates, about 2 inches out of the ground. And there does not seem to be a debate in the briefing as to the obvious risk that this sign base poses. We have briefed pretty extensively, and like I said, the district court did not get to the analysis of the harm and anticipation of the harm. And with my remaining seconds, I'll just note there is not any record facts as to the city anticipating the harm. This plaintiff herself traversed this area many, many, many times without coming into contact. And there's no record facts as to the location's busyness or lack thereof.
So does the fact that the respondent walked this route so many times and never noticed it, doesn't that cut against the open and obvious argument? And also, isn't that evidence on the record that is disputed then about whether in fact it was open and obvious?
Your Honor, yes. The plaintiff herself traverses this area without incident. And that, I think, based on the length of time, and so we have this time where the sign base goes down, and it, if I may, should I respond to the end of this question? Thank you. At the time the sign is discovered to be down, there's snowbanks. And then over many, many weeks, we have a melting and now brand new clear sidewalks. And the court can see what the condition looked like on the day in question with exhibit number G.
Are you saying, though, that in fact the evidence in the record that she'd walked that route and never seen it does not create a genuine issue of material fact?
As to visibility of it on the day she encounters it, no. I think that that does not create a genuine dispute because the plaintiff herself testified that on the day she encountered it, she trips, she sits up, she can see what she can identify what she tripped on. As to anticipation of the harm, that's where the restatement in its comments discussed that those types of facts as to safely traversing the area will cut against the idea that the landowner should anticipate any harm from this, because clearly people have been able to avoid it as there has not been an issue.
Okay. Thank you. All right, we will have another 15 minutes added to the clock, and we will turn to Ms. Ballmer for, excuse me, argument. Ms. Orcutt, if you could just mute yours. And Ms. Ballmer, the 15 minutes are on the clock. You can begin when you are ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Ballmer. I represent respondent Brianne Goad. I will address appellant's three bases for appeal in turn. First, appellant has asked the court to correct the district court's ruling regarding governmental immunity and failure to warn cases. As the court has seen, the trial court cited the correct statute regarding governmental immunity and then used the proper analysis pursuant to Stanky versus Andover. They went on to hold that there simply wasn't enough information in the record to determine what, if any, policies or procedures were in place and that the court agreed that the information provided by the city simply was not enough. Now, we have not heard anything from appellant regarding these findings. In other words, those findings have not been appealed, and those findings were the basis for the court's decision on this point. The parts of the trial court's decision that appellant is complaining of are dicta and did not play a part in the trial court's decision.
Ms. Bomer, why wasn't the Hackler affidavit saying, this is the policy, you know, we wait till someone gives us a heads up because it's too expensive to just to do spot checks? Why wasn't that information enough to determine whether or not they were acting in a policy-making manner?
Yes. As the court has already discussed with counsel for appellant, there are a number of cases that delineate the very fact-specific analysis that entails whether a policy or procedure is enough to merit immunity. And in this case, the Hackler affidavit, in addition to the Hackler testimony and all the other statements in this case, were simply not enough for the trial court to summarily find immunity at this point. So
what was missing?
Any policy or procedure, Your Honor. I respectfully maintain that what we have here is a series of case-by-case admittedly.
Does it have to be a written policy?
No.
Okay.
No.
So am I correct in describing the policy as, we don't have enough money to do spot checks, we wait for someone to call us, and then if someone does call us, we go out and fix it? Would you agree, Ms. Bomer, that's the policy?
I don't agree that it's a policy. I agree that that's what appellants are claiming is their policy.
What's missing? So what I said is not enough. Why is it not enough?
Well, for one thing, it doesn't include any reference to a balancing of policy considerations. So I understand that the city has maintained that there isn't enough money. Every business, every landowner, has or does not have money. And so that's not enough. We don't have any reference to safety considerations, political considerations. Again, the case law has done a lovely job of listing all the different considerations that could and should be considered in a landowner's policy analysis, a governmental entity's policy analysis. What we have here is, with all due respect, legal counsel arguing after the fact that what the operational City of Duluth employees admitted themselves were case-by-case reactionary decisions, we have an after-the-fact argument that that constitutes policy. And that's not enough, Your Honor. the going back to appellant's complaints about the trial court's finding, again, we have these statements that the court made. The Steinke court, having held that immunity should not be afforded, I actually share counsel's concern about this statement where immunity should not be afforded when decisions involve warning the public of known hazards. It's not as detailed as it might be to go on and clarify what the Supreme Court ended up clarifying in the Steinke decision. Here we have the Steinke Supreme Court decision referencing the Steinke Court of Appeals decision. But again, the important part here, Your Honor, is that it was not a factor in the ultimate decision. The other reference in the trial court's analysis of immunity that appellant complains of is the statement that even if there was a policy in place, it would not absolve the city. This is a hypothetical, Your Honor, which is a clear example of dicta. Again, it did not apply to the ultimate decision making. And then finally, Your Honor, even if the court disagrees with me on all these points, respondent has alleged a number of causes of action in this case, not just failure to warrant. And so we do have these additional causes of action that would survive. Moving on to the second basis for appellant's appeal, appellant has asked the court to correct the trial court's ruling on immunity because it believes that they did submit enough evidence of policies and procedures. I've already made some comments in this regard. Certainly the court has our briefings in which we both go into detail about what existing case law requires. What I wanted to mention though is that I wanted to mention a little further that there is no balancing of factors here. Generally, policy requires the governmental entity who is known for balancing these different factors to put forth some explanation as to why they would do this on a reactionary basis, why they would wait for someone to get hurt before they do something about a hazard. And there's been little to no discussion about this policy, as it were, and what we do about person one, ground zero, who is the first person to alert the city about a hazard. I would think we should have some sort of deliberation about what we do about person one in light of this policy. And in this case, Brianne Goad is person one. She is the first person about whom we learn having been injured. Now, there's references in the record to other people having been injured and the city being notified. These are fact issues. We have a lot of he said, she said in this case, and all those issues should go to a jury. But again, as I mentioned earlier, our position is that there simply was not enough policy or procedure to merit a finding of immunity at the summary judgment stage.
Do you agree that if the city had constructive notice, that's not enough? They have to have actual notice?
I don't necessarily agree because in this case, counsel has referenced that if a plaintiff alleges constructive notice against a governmental entity, then it brings us into this difficult failure to warn analysis. In this case, constructive notice does not necessarily have to mean that the plaintiff is attacking a policy or procedure. And so I think both the arguments and the briefings have been limited to that very narrow construction of constructive notice. I think a governmental entity can have different versions of constructive notice, and this is an excellent example of that, Your Honor.
Well,
As the
let's say for the sake of argument, I don't agree that it's necessary to have actual notice. Would it be fair to say the record doesn't indicate that any City of Duluth employee, either in an affidavit or in his deposition, said, "Yeah, we knew that the sign base was there." Would that be a fair statement?
Your Honor, we do not have a recent testimony of a City of Duluth employee saying that. That is correct.
So what, as I understand, you can correct me, what you've got is some of the hospital people, in, I don't know, messages or documents, I think it's mostly documents, saying, yeah, and they knew about it, something like that. Is that sort of what you have for actual notice?
Yes, Your Honor. We
Okay.
have
So how is that? So first of all, would you agree that that's the Ms. Orcutt makes the point that that's all inadmissible hearsay, and you can't rely on that. So first of all, do you agree that those documents, those statements, are inadmissible hearsay?
I don't agree,
Okay,
and
why not? Why aren't?
First of all, the issue wasn't raised at the trial court level, so I don't believe the issue was preserved for appeal. Second of all, there are a number of exceptions to the hearsay rule that would apply in this case, one of which is excited utterance, one of which is recorded recollection, and then the last of which are records of regularly conducted business activity.
Well, I mean, explain to me how excited utterance applies. I mean, I didn't see anything that said, "Oh my, I'm shocked that people are falling down." I mean, that's
Yes,
probably not
John.
going to work. But so your argument is that it comes in because let's say they're business records of the hospital, and that's, but why would that bind? Okay, it's their business records, but how does that show? All right, fair enough. I understand the argument. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the circumstantial evidence argument, which I believe is one of the biggest issues in this case, because what we have are a number of conflicting statements and documents, and it is very messy, Your Honor. We have documents reflecting statements that witnesses made at one point, and then we have people to some extent recanting, and then we have witnesses saying, you know what, I really don't remember at this point. Which is unfortunately very common when you have litigation that has gone on for 4 years, which is the case in the instant matter. But as I mentioned in my brief, circumstantial evidence is enough. And in this case, All of these are fact issues that are critical to the determination of the ultimate facts. And if the courts dismissed all cases in which we had credibility, recollection issues, everything that follows with a case where there are a lot of people involved over a long period of time, we wouldn't have many cases left. And so because the nature of the issues on which these witnesses have made these statements and then followed with deposition testimony, and in some cases, affidavits, this is a very complicated set of facts that the trial court properly held should go to a jury so that the jury can decide who and who is not credible. Now, in this case, we have appellant who is a governmental entity and who admittedly has a reactionary response to people getting injured on city property. We have a number of witnesses who do and do not remember who said what to the city at various points. Now, this is related to the issue of whether there is or is not enough policy. Because of the disorganized nature of the city's position on complaints and their response to these complaints, so too is it disorganized who said what to whom when. And as the depositions and records and affidavits all reflect, there are a number of discrepancies in this regard. And respectfully, if we had a situation where everybody was on the same page about all of the facts, this would certainly be a cleaner case for the courts, but it isn't. And because of the nature of this case, our position is that the trial court correctly demurred to letting the fact finder make the ultimate decisions in this case.
Well, I'm curious to discuss a little bit whether or not we're here on an interlocutory appeal, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm wondering whether we even reach the second two issues that both sides are talking about here. Are we really limited just to the immunity issue?
Well, my position certainly is that the trial court ruled correctly on all three. Are you asking whether if the trial court, if you reverse the trial court's finding on immunity, must you reach the other two points?
Well, essentially, I'm saying from the outset, when we're looking at what we can consider in an interlocutory appeal, are we limited in this instance to the discretionary immunity issue? Because the other two issues are not actually inextricably intertwined with that issue. So it's a little bit different, I think, than saying if we decide this, then we don't reach those because logically we don't get there.
I see your point. I think I see your point, Your Honor. Certainly, I would agree with that statement that it's limited to the immunity issue. But as I just mentioned, I do think there are some problems with the he said, she said element that do interrelate the policy issue, which is part of the immunity analysis, with notice and the openness and obviousness issue. I do think the openness and obviousness issue stands on its own, but that, of course, wasn't your question. So I think in a broad sense, it would be limited to the immunity, but I can see an argument being made for the inexplicably intertwined as well. I hope that answered your question, Your Honor. The last point I'd like to make, which I'm sure the court has heard in countless cases involving premises liability, and negligences, we have all these very genuine issues of material fact. They're disputed. We had an appeals brief that claimed in a multitude of areas that there was no evidence. But of course, the court will form its own opinion about that. And our position is that the trial court correctly ruled on all these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And now we will turn back to counsel for the appellant for the last word. So we have 5 minutes on the clock. And Ms. Orca, if you could begin by answering the question that I just asked opposing counsel, I would appreciate that.
Could the court remind me of her final question to opposing counsel?
So the question is whether, in fact, the only question that is appropriately before us on an interlocutory appeal here is the issue of immunity. And therefore, the other two issues are not so closely aligned or intertwined with that issue so as to be really appropriate for us to consider at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court can reach all of the arguments presented in this appeal, specifically the intertwinedness of constructive and actual notice and how that applies with immunity is laid out in the Dietman versus City of Rochester decision from this court in 2009. That's where this court discusses how actual notice, immunity, and constructive notice all intertwine. Open and obviousness, it sure does, it's its own basis for awarding summary judgment. We thought that in the interest of judicial economy, it would make sense to bring that to this court because we think this case is so clearly fits right into that doctrine and what is a visible object that causes someone to trip on a sidewalk and the fact that the city should not have had any anticipation of harm in that case. So the court absolutely can take up all of the issues presented to it. I believe at one point counsel had argued that the hearsay issues weren't preserved for appeal. Those were argued in oral argument to the district court as well as briefed. So that is in the record and the way in which the documents don't meet the hearsay exceptions to negate the actual notice. So cities are not liable unless and until they have notice of a condition, and that notice can be actual or constructive. We've talked a lot in my initial arguments about constructive notice. I'd like to turn to actual notice. The reason we discuss in our briefing why there's no genuine dispute of material fact is all of the St. Luke's employee document or testimony, they all boil back to the employee Lounsbury. He's the only person who ever saw the sign being down, and he's the only person who would have told the city. Although he testifies in his deposition that he didn't, that he doesn't remember, and he's very clear on that in his deposition. Counsel used the word recanted. He absolutely recanted. Specifically, he testifies that he saw the sign being down, assumed it was a city plow, and so the city's going to come get their sign. You know, he made an assumption about what the city will or won't do because he assumed the city was at fault for the sign being down in the first place. And I would note that the district court did drop a footnote here on the causation of the down sign. In footnote four on addendum page six, the district court found there's generally a lack of evidence to pinpoint who or what is responsible for the sign being knocked down. So we aren't in a causation direct negligence case. What we're left with is just this notice of a condition, actual or constructive. The documents that are the St. Luke's documents, all of those statements are a after the fact, you know, weeks after the fact, repeating the statement of Lounsbury. So Lounsbury presents a report via the online portal to the city the day that the plaintiff falls and says, yep, the city knew about it. And that exact statement is simply repeated in all of these documents that were all created after the fact. So I think we're solidly within, solidly without, excuse me, the hearsay exceptions. And I don't think those records are coming in. And we did argue that to the district court. So we have a one employee where all of this assumption and speculation about who knew what when stems from. And then we have that employee recanting on his deposition that he ever provided notice. And then we have the city's evidence from its employees that it never received notice. So there's no genuine issue that the city had actual notice. There's no facts on it. There's just speculation and assumption. And I think that shouldn't go to a jury. I think that's a waste of the jury's time because at the end of the day, all we're going to be able to ask the jury to do is speculate And that's not the standard. So I think this court should absolutely take up all issues presented. I think that the record is, there's a lot in this record, especially with the compounding third-party complaint status. There's a lot of briefing and a lot of testimony presented, but I'm confident that this court, in reviewing the record in full, will see there's no genuine issue of material fact for any of the notices. Immunity applies for constructive notice, and that this was an open and obvious condition. So we'd ask that the court enter summary judgment for the city.
Okay, thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your argument here today, as well as the briefs that were submitted. And the court will take this matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the applicable timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.